Welcome to the Mommy Matters podcast, where Mommy Matters is a double entendre that states and declares that mommies matter, where we have conversations surrounding mommy matters from conception to pregnancy to postpartum, mother and father wounds, dating, mindfulness and self-care, spirituality, parenting, discipline, legislation, money, and so much more. It is my hope and my prayer that the information that you gather here serves as a blueprint for generational and individual ascension. Enjoy.
I'll say on the computer. All right, welcome to the Mommy Matters podcast, where we discuss all things mommy matters. And today we are discussing postpartum recovery and nutrition. And if you don't know, my name is Cecile Edwards, your podcast host and postpartum doula and educator, facilitator on all things self-care and wellness for women and mothers postpartum. So I am so excited to have a guest today. And my guest is the author of the Postnatal Cookbook, Simple and Nutritious Recipes to Nourish Your Body and Spirit During the Fourth Trimester. Yes, there is a fourth trimester, everyone. And Jaren Soloff will give you an introduction of who she is, what she does, and we'll jump into the conversation on how you can take better care of yourself and command better care for yourself in that fourth trimester. So, Jaren?
Yes, thank you for having me. I feel like this topic, obviously, you and I are really passionate about and on the same page about. I could tell you a little bit about my background, and we could talk maybe a little bit about Postnatal Cookbook too, and how that kind of came to be. I'm a registered dietitian and also a board certified lactation consultant, or an IBCLC. Birth teams, and I really combine both of those credentials in my private practice. It's called Full Circle, and my focus really is about helping to support moms not only in their postpartum recovery, but really supporting them in their relationship with food and body. And Full Circle is about thinking about how our relationships with food and body, or when we are to those relationships, really impacts our kids. And so it's really about, you know, coming full circle and making sure that we're bringing our own healing to our kids, and we're not passing on diet culture, we're not passing on weight stigma to our children. So yeah. I provide, you know, both the nutrition piece and the lactation piece, you know, and love kind of being able to talk to moms in this way and think about how we can work towards taking better care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that it's called Full Circle, right? Because we are taught, I feel like, oftentimes to take pieces of things and not see how they're interconnected. And, mm-hmm. you know, that whole diet culture and this idea that after having, you know, pushing out a whole human being, that the priority should be how well you can snap back is so ridiculous. And I'm sure that, you know, that's something that you may have heard a lot of in your, you know, women being concerned about getting their body back. And I just want to talk about like what that, why, you know, why is there so much pressure for women to do that? What have you seen in your practice that you have had to, because of course, in anything, there's a mindset behind mm-hmm. diet culture. There's a mindset behind the snapback thing. What is your, observations? What are your observations?
Yeah. Well, it's a huge, I mean, it's systemic. And I mean, we could go down a whole rabbit hole there, but it is weight stigma and fat phobia. And there's both what's called, you know, external weight stigma and fat phobia, and there's what's called internalized weight stigma and fat phobia. And I will touch on the internalized weight stigma and fat phobia, because I think that's important and how it shows up for moms. But I think of, you know, diet culture is this constant echoing of, you know, what our body should look like. And if you're not losing weight, you're not trying hard enough. And, you know, if you're not eating the quote, quote, right things, which always seems to change, right? Because every few years there's a new diet or new superfoods that, you know, are better for you. If you are not doing those things, which are huge money makers, they're capitalistic in nature, then, you know, you are not taking care of yourself is a message.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, you know, it's huge in terms of how we internalize that and this ideal of thinness and, you know, mobility and autonomy and all of those different pieces that go along with what living in a smaller body means. And I should say too, that I have a ton of privilege in my body. I live in a smaller body. I have a lot of autonomy. So, you know, I'm speaking from that place, but in terms of how it plays out for moms, it's important to think about like the messages we get during pregnancy and postpartum, which is that it feels like it's acceptable to gain weight during pregnancy and like you're cute, you got a baby bump, you know, are like eating for two, quote, quote. And then as soon as you have the baby, there's this expectation that you need to get your body back because you're in line back with those narratives again of having to be subjected to whatever your body should be. I know I said a lot there, but yeah, I think that there's some huge pieces of, you know, weight stigma and just how we view bodies, especially when women become mothers too.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the economic piece and how, you know, if you cannot purchase the latest thing or do the latest thing, you know, the latest thing now is, I don't want to like name particular diets. I've done this particular diet and it worked for me because of my personal body's needs. The ketogenic diet, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a very specific way of eating that some people may not be able to do. So that's, you know, part of my privilege, or eating certain foods, organic foods, or, you know, doing those kinds of things that people assume. And it really takes away the people of other cultures and the way that they eat and the way that they, and it's a very complex dynamic. So I love that you brought that up, because there's a lot of foods, for example, from other cultures that, you know, Western mindset will take on, right? And not realizing that this is a part of people's entire culture. Like this is the way they've eaten for centuries and millennia or whatever the case may be. And I also love that you highlighted how, you know, we talk about the physical changes or the changes as mothers, like we're having the baby, we change when we're pregnant. And it's like, it's not acceptable that you should be different physically after having a baby. Everything else can be different, right? But if you're different physically, it's like, you shouldn't be different physically. That's not acceptable, right? And it's really, when you think about it, it's so controlling in a lot of ways. And I can identify personally with the internalized fat phobia, because I've always been, you know, I've never been thin in my life. And I feel like I've always been on this roller coaster of dieting or the diet culture. And of recent, I've decided that I'm no longer doing that. And I'm really getting in tune with my body, because that's ultimately what it does. It takes you out of tune with your body, right? It's like, you don't even know what you need or want anymore, because your brain is telling you what you've heard, right?
Exactly.
And this is huge, because, you know, as a mother of a young girl, especially a teenage girl, where at this age, they start to really have these ideas about whether or not they're acceptable in so many ways. You know, I have to be conscientious of not saying, you know, oh, I'm not going to eat that because of this, or I'm not, you know what I'm saying? And really being very just in tune with myself to demonstrate and to mimic that, that. And so let's jump into the book, because we can talk all day, but the book, the postnatal cookbook, which has some amazing recipes in there that really is balanced and takes into account nutrition, mm-hmm. right? So we're always, you know, talking about the food, and the nutrition of the food, but really we need to know what kind of nutrition is right for our bodies, right? So let's talk about, you know, that and what kind of nutrition is best for a postpartum mother usually, right? Because I know in my culture, my family is from Jamaica. And so the foods that are given to postpartum women, which I'm going to do another series about, but it's high carb food, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that's food that most people are like, stay away from it, you know, but that's what people have been using forever, you know, in that culture. And that's the same in a lot of African cultures as well, you know. So I just wanted to get your perspective on that from your professional standpoint. What are the quote unquote best foods?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love you sharing that, because that is, you know, one of the pieces that I talk about in when I was studying, you know, trying to find out different nutritional practices. I looked into, you know, outside of Western culture, most other countries have some type of nutrition postpartum ritual for helping moms to heal after birth. And that type of food can change, right? And what kind of shows up on there. So for example, you know, you were sharing about a different type of carbohydrates, or there's might be different types of like root vegetables. Mexico, there's different, you know, soups and stews, and in Asia, there's different types of foods that kind of show up. But what I did is I kind of tried to look at all of these different food practices. And while the actual food items changed, the principles were similar in nature. Mm-hmm. And I talk about some of those in the book, and you know, you probably know some of these from being a postpartum doula too, but you know, one of them is talking about how emphasizing food should be really warming. There's this kind of idea that after birth, you know, there's blood loss, there's fluid loss, that warming foods can be really supportive. And I was trying to find, you know, actual like nutrition evidence for these pieces, right? And we want to try to be evidence-based. And I think this is where it is a really careful balance of like, you know, birth and postpartum, like so many, especially when it comes to food. I mean, food is love, food is tradition, food is family. And that kind of stuff cannot necessarily be quantitative data. You know, so when people are like, I'm the nutrition professional, you should eat this, but like your family, every time someone in your family has a baby and they make you, you know, this certain dish, and it's made with love and it's warm and it has, you know, the spices, and culturally it's something that is really valuable. I mean, there is a lot of meaning and healing in that. Mm-hmm. So I think it really has to be a balance of, you know, cultural foods, of foods that, you know, the mother prefers and the family prefers. Of course, there are things that we can look at nutrition wise to be supportive. I was talking about, you know, warming foods, both in temperature and also in spice level. So some of those, you know, diverse different type of recipes, not what we think of as like diet foods, like salads and smoothies, but like soups and stews and curries and different types of teas, like all of those with different herbs can be really supportive. The second piece is throughout a lot of different cultures, there's protein rich recipes. So, you know, meats that are like slow cooked or cooked on the bone, because they maintain a lot of collagen, which is a protein that can help us recover after birth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a few kind of other pieces, but the tenet is really that what is so different here in Western culture is that other people are preparing these foods for the mom. Mm-hmm. So there is this respect for the process that the mom has just been through, and, you know, helping to prioritize taking care of that mom to help her recover and replenish from birth, versus, you know, here in the US, we have at best like a meal train with some casseroles, right? But typically we don't have, you know, our in-laws or our family coming to stay with us and live with us. We don't have that intergenerational living that is really common in most other cultures after birth.
Yes, for all of it. Because as you were you talking about the food, I was in my mind, I was thinking it's not just the food, it's the rituals behind the preparation and the being with the mom and, you know, ensuring that she's okay so that she is not stressed. And I have a personal theory that the fact that a lot of the foods are warm has to do with it just not stressing the digestive system and its ability to digest easily. So, you know, all of those things I think come into play in some way physiologically and mentally and, you know, for your brain and all of those things. And so, yeah, interesting that all of these cultures, the indigenous cultures, have that as the mainstay in their practices. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people are now recognizing that and trying to incorporate those things into their practices. But I also just want to, you know, think about that it's not about the weight, it's about how you feel. Like, you know, it's how your body feels, whether or not you feel energized, whether or not you're getting enough rest, whether or not, you know, how you feel. And so this, I think, is a segue into something that you talk about a lot in the book as well, which is the mental and emotional support that women receive during the postpartum period. And I know for myself personally, like I received the nutritional support. You know, my daughter's father was there to make the meals. Sometimes he made things that I was like, I don't want to eat. but the mental and emotional is not there. And I think, you know, I was far away from my family, even though I was in a country that is very woman-centered around having birth. And I had a few friends. It wasn't the same, I feel like, as if I would have had more people around me to really wait on me hand and foot. And that affected me ultimately in having postpartum depression and dealing with other physical issues, including significant weight gain from the stresses. And so, you know, I want to really talk about that and how nutrition supports that, as well as the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. So nutrition and its impact on mental health is huge. Mm-hmm. I always say to my clients and remind myself that food is a mood altering substance. And what I mean by that is that it has the power to change our mood, right? So negatively or positively, if you are undernourishing yourself, or if you are, you know, not, whether, you know, and I was going to say not prioritizing nutrition, but of course, you know, there are socioeconomic factors that impact someone's nutrition and how much access they have to food too. So, or if they don't have access in some way, that can negatively impact their health and their mental health, right? And increase their risk of postpartum depression or perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. Or it can positively impact our mood, right? And it can help us produce appropriate amounts of mood regulating chemicals. So for example, serotonin and dopamine. One of the things that I see most often, because, you know, I work with women specifically who have a difficult relationship with food, and that maybe they have been dieting or they have some disordered eating, is that, you know, restricting or overeating or these types of food behaviors, they're actually incredibly intelligent in terms of trying to regulate your mood. So what I mean by that is, like, you might have some underlying symptoms of postpartum depression or anxiety and be overeating carbohydrates because you're trying to get a higher boost of serotonin. Right. Or you might be restricting foods intentionally because it helps. There's actually some evidence in certain individuals with brains that restricting can increase, you know, serotonin, and you get kind of a high or a rush from it. Depending on, you know, what stressors are going on in your life, you know, you might be using these in order to try to regulate your mood. Our hope is that, you know, we can get to a point where if we're working on self-care and nutrition, your brain and body can get back in balance and you won't need to use those tools. But, you know, I always validate, like, you are so intelligent for using those tools to try to regulate your mood, because it must be really difficult in how you're feeling mentally right now.
Mm, that is so powerful. That is extreme, because we tend to beat ourselves up for wanting a cookie or eating, you know, chips or whatever the case may be. Cause I know that was me. I was a carby, you know, at some point in my life. And that did two things. It was intelligent for my body. So it served my body, but it also let my body become dependent on something that was not the healthiest for me to boost my, you know, serotonin. And that was something that has been a huge, that and fasting. I can attest personally, because I do intermittent fasting, and I can attest personally that it does help boost your mood, because I don't know why, but it does. Like, I just feel more energetic and energized when I do it personally. And sometimes it just takes time to learn your body. And so, you know, one of the things that you highlighted in your book was hydration, and even how that even affects your body, right? So we tend to know that we need to drink water and stay hydrated, but what are the best ways to stay hydrated? And what, how does that really impact your body, a postpartum body or a prenatal or pregnant body? How does that happen?
So important. I think we hear a lot about it, you know, and in terms of postpartum and your needs, it's always best to try to drink to thirst, or try to drink before you approach that thirst. That's kind of a late signal of, you know, not getting enough hydration. But especially if you are breastfeeding, so like in the initial postpartum period, if you choose to breastfeed, then your increased fluid, your needs are much higher. And because breastfeeding works on oxytocin, that love hormone, it can increase your thirst too. So, you know, everybody's needs are different, but they are much higher than that 64 ounces that we typically think of. So I encourage moms to keep, you know, like we all have kind of like our big water bottles now, right? If you are breastfeeding, different like stations around the house, like carry your water bottle with you. So when you sit down and you're nursing, you, of course, as soon as you sit down and feed the baby, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm thirsty. Right? So carrying that with you and making sure that you can try to drink to thirst and meet those needs is important. There's a lot of fluid loss that can happen after birth. So part of your increased fluid needs are also about replenishing some of those that are lost during birth.
Mm-hmm. So yes, and I took note that you definitely stated, you talked about going back to what you said about cravings and their meeting the needs, how nutritionally demanding your body, you know, you have nutritional demands, and that sometimes, you know, those cravings that you have meet those nutritional demands. And I remember being pregnant. I'm sure most women have some pregnancy story about the things that they crave, that they were like, why do I crave this thing here?
Yeah.
But it was nutritional, but it was probably an emotional support too, and a stress reducer, as you were saying about food doing that. Because I know I ate an exorbitant amount of ice cream.
Yes.
Unapologetically, it was really good ice cream, Italian gelato type ice cream.
That's amazing.
And I realized that it was just providing a certain level of fat in my diet that I just needed for, you know, my brain and my developing child's brain. And, you know, it was fresh ice cream, so it was actually the best kind that I could get, you know? And so that's something to think about. I don't know about like weird cravings, like when people have cravings for like paint chips or something. I don't know, but
that can be harmful. Definitely. Yeah. It's like not any non-food items can be, you know, really harmful and a sign of a bigger deficiency overall. But yeah, that's such a great connection, because, you know, ice cream is calorie rich, right? Which is just energy. Calories don't have to be bad, but that is really common, you know, of like, oh my gosh, I can't control myself around candy, so I don't just keep it in the house, right? But is it that you can't control yourself, or is that you never allow yourself access to it? And when it does come around, you feel like you're never going to get it again. right? So that's deprivation. Or you're not eating enough, and energy and candy is the most effective form of energy in that it's quick carbohydrates. You're not going to go towards an apple because your body has to break it down. You need something that's going to increase your blood sugar very quickly, right? So if we see someone who has like diabetes, you give them orange juice or glucose because you need to raise their blood sugar very quickly. You're not going to give them an apple with fiber that's going to take long to digest.
I just love that you said that because I'm literally
resonated.
Mindset that I've had to unravel. I'm like, I would just not have certain things in the house and then I would get it and it would just be like, and I've seen it with my daughter too. You know, mm-hmm. I don't put like soda and juice in the home, but when we like summertime is approaching, cookouts, hopefully, you know, Corona, who knows, mm-hmm. but, you know, and one time we went to a cookout and I kid you not, I don't even know how many sodas she drank. I saw like three. So Lord knows it might have been more than that.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, you know, I still don't put soda in the house, but I definitely made her aware of it. Like, you know, you're drinking that because you feel like you don't have it regularly, but you don't need mm-hmm. to, you know, right. If your body doesn't desire it. It just doesn't desire it, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't keep it in the house because I keep other forms of sweets in the house, right? Fruits.
Yeah.
You know, you can, you know, create something, some lemonade, some fresh lemonade with some brown sugar or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and sometimes again, it's cultural, like, you know, children are eating certain foods like these, I've seen a lot of children eating these Takis, for example. And I'm like, but when I think about it, when we were younger, there were certain things that were like the snack, you know, to eat. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things come into play when you're considering thinking about diet culture and what that means, you know, and that's something that just came to me as you were speaking. But let's speak about also mm-hmm. the component of our families feeding us, right? Because this is a process of nurturing the mom, not just nutritionally, but mentally, spiritually, all of that. And sometimes, you know, people will try to, your family members will try to have you restrict, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Or just give you whatever to eat that's not nutritionally sound. And so I think it's important to talk to the family, you know, including dad, mm-hmm. right? Or partner or whatever yeah. about that. Have you ever had to incorporate or done that where you've incorporated the family into the conversation with me?
About, you know, supporting nutrition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I have a lot of partners. What I've seen is partners who want to be supportive, you know, how can I support their recovery? Or just, you know, after birth in general, right? We talk about preparing for birth, but we're not planning for postpartum in the same way. And I've started to really have conversations of like, even the postnatal cookbook, I think could be a great start of like, here, you know, here's some great recipes. Can you cook some of these for me? Can you freeze some? If people want to bring you meals, could you pull from these recipe pages? I'm really interested in some of these. If people are asking and offering help and, you know, trying to support, I think you can, you know, be a little bit more direct in your communication in terms of here's what would be really supportive for me. And of course, when we're talking about families and new babies, I always think about boundaries. and that might be part of your boundary too, you know, whether it's like certain comments on food or comments on your body, like boundaries are huge. And I think you and I, you have a 13-year-old, I have a 9-year-old. It's a constant in being a parent is setting boundaries with Ooh. Other people in your family, with your kids, right? So it's definitely a good postpartum exercise.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely critical to, you know, have the family in. Just being mm-hmm. educated about it. Everybody is really just education, right? It's really education because, and it's funny that you say that about the children because I recently had a falling out with an aunt who I had to tell, you know, and I've had to tell family members before about this. Like one, I don't like the idea of comparing my child to another child. That's just out of the question. And, you know, every time you encounter someone talking about their weight is not acceptable. Like, why is that the center of what you think about first instead of being concerned about their well-being, mm-hmm. their actual well-being? And this is something that we need to shift generationally, culturally. It's like, why is there? I know that our eyes see and take in, but we have to be more attuned and mature to know that what you see is not always what it means, right? So you have to be astute in asking questions, actually being of concern of the person. And I really believe that this is why the self-care movement is so powerful, because, you know, people are having to turn inward and really see how they're taking care of themselves, and their lack thereof is why they are not able to really support others in the way that is sustainable and holistic and whole in that way. So another thing, and this may be the final thing, if so, because I can talk about so many things. I have so many questions and underlines in this book. I'm not even getting to all of it. But but in one part, you talked about, there's a specific chapter on mental health, chapter 4. Mm-hmm. And you talked about breastfeeding difficulties and cultural factors that may impact a woman's risk of developing postpartum depression. So mm-hmm. breastfeeding is a movement currently, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm very happy about, because to me it's like, hey, if it's coming out of your body, listen, just make it happen. Mm-hmm. But there's mm-hmm. a lot to consider around that. You know, if you do not have the support, then that can bring on some issues. So,
yes. Yes. So, you know, and this is my lactation consultant kind of piece here. And I think that people assume that if you're a lactation consultant, that you are about, you know, breastfeeding at all costs, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone can breastfeed. If it didn't happen, you're not trying hard enough, or you didn't want it bad enough, like kind of the same shaming messages we get around food and weight, right? And it is not about, you know, I mean, it is undoubtedly that, and most women know that, we know that breast milk and breastfeeding is better for our babies. That's not the question. It is about informed consent, because it is, I mean, some people's journeys to trying to breastfeed at the sacrifice of their mental health, of their relationships with their partner, of, you know, their attunement with their baby, it just doesn't work for them, you know, for whatever reason. There's a lot of different causes, but a lot of it is, you know, lack of support, right? Or access to, you know, good informed care. So I do want everyone to get access to that. But, you know, if at any point after that, you know, an individual makes a decision that they do not want to continue to breastfeed, or they want to change how they're feeding their baby, it's just my job to give them all the tools, and they get to make what decision is right for their family. So we respect autonomy and individual choice as much as possible. And informed consent is having all of the information you need to make a decision that's best for you. It is not breastfeeding at all costs.
Absolutely. I love that.
Yeah.
The final thing that I absolutely love that you say in the book, and something that I know personally I've said a million times, and it's actually what started my whole personal movement around. It's mm-hmm. like, what messages and what did I learn before even having a child? And in your book, you say that, you know, planning for postpartum starts before even having a child.
Yep.
So it's like, how are we teaching about the, you know, in school when we have home economics, and teaching about, I don't even remember learning about having babies or anything like that in there. But if we were to, when we do start having those conversations, because that is a huge conversation now where we're trying to include that in school curriculum, the conversation needs to be about how to plan mentally, emotionally, you know, nutritionally, before you even have a baby. And it's really just living a certain life of being, you know, empowered within yourself to make the choices that you desire to make and be your best self on your terms, because nobody can understand what you're feeling and what's going on with you inside of you, right? And I think that's a huge thing, especially with the rates these days of infant mortality and mother mortality, especially in communities of color. Mm-hmm. And you see stories like, you know, that of Serena Williams, where, you know, she had to really advocate for herself because she's like, there's something wrong and they're not listening to her. Mm-hmm. Imagine people who cannot advocate for themselves or don't have the support, you know, with them. So all of these things are things that you can't just do on the fly. It's something that you really have to consider and think about and know and be empowered within yourself. So with that, if you have any final thoughts, and again, the book is wonderful. It has the different meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner, things that are quick, things that are easy. Again, you can give this to your people in your life where, you know, they can create these meals for you. And maybe that's a part of what they do or whatever, you know. Don't be afraid of the cultural foods that your family may know about, you know, because I know, again, my culture, a lot of carbs. I know a Mexican culture is a lot of fat, you know, is it? And people tend to shy away from that. But if that's part of your culture, it might be what's best for your body and your DNA and all of that. But anywho, so definitely pick up the book, Postpartum Postnatal Cookbook. And it has the recipes, but it also has information on empowering yourself as a family, really, right? So, Jaren, any last words, and also sharing your information, how people can connect with you, all of those things.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I would love to get the postnatal cookbook into more hands just because I think it's a huge part of my hope to support moms after birth and having that community. I talk about in the book that, you know, we always hear in parenting it takes a village, and it really does. Like, having that support and that pre-planning is so helpful. So I do provide virtual services for individual support for nutrition counseling. You know, if anything I shared resonated with you, I work more on helping support individuals with their relationship with food. So I don't prescribe diets. Sometimes we do, you know, meal plans if that can be helpful, but it's more about a counseling-based approach. And you can find me, my practice is Full Circle. So my website is fullcrcl.co. And you can also get a free sample on my website. So I have 5 free sample recipes and a little sneak peek of the book as well, just to see if you want to take a look.
Excellent, excellent. I love it. So definitely connect for your needs, because these are ways that we need to be supported and take care of ourselves. And why not gain the support, right? Mm-hmm. And you can grab the book on Amazon.
Yep. You can grab it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. There's some smaller retailers too, Books a Million and Powell Books. But I know we've all been living off Amazon while we've been at home these past few months, right?
Yeah. It's like the place. Yeah. Yes. All right. Well, thank you all for listening to the Mommy Matters podcast. I hope that this was useful and helpful for you to shift yourself, mind, body, and spirit. And I look forward to hearing you or seeing you or having you listen on the next show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Did you like that? I know it was as informative for you as it was for me. Look, this is a process for all of us. And to keep this process going, I would love to invite you to donate to our podcast. We want to continue to give you high-level content, beautiful content that enlightens and inspires and broadens your vision to elevate you and evolve. So please feel free to go to the podcast page at anchor.fm/mommymatters. We would love to hear your questions and comments as well, so that we can discuss them in future podcasts. And you can email that to momevolve@gmail.com. You can also visit the website and send your comments there. www.mommyevolve.com. And I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. Peace and love.